This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years of craftsmanship, April 3rd through 30th. For a store location near you, you can visit www.peets.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
To be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Delanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Diller, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Oregon schools get more money at a special session of the Oregon Legislature. Adelante Mujeres offers empowerment to Oregon Latinas, and human rights activists are calling for an investigation into charges that Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld directed the torture of a prisoner at Abu Ghraib.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,738 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,100 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 38,660 civilians have been killed by military intervention in Iraq. In 2004, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 20th, 2006. I'm Eduardo Delanderos Tierre.
And I'm Marlise. At its special session today, the Oregon State Legislature passed a bill that allows Portland Public Schools to restore an expired property tax. The tax is expected $15 million for the school district. Governor Ted Gulongoski and several lawmakers backed the bill in the special legislative session today, saying the state needs to come to the aid of the district that has been struggling with low enrollment and financial problems.
Farm workers at Three Mile Canyon Farms do not face harmful exposure to ammonia or hydrogen sulfide, according to a recently issued report. Field investigators for the National Institute for Occupational Health and Safety conducted a review last August in response to claims from the United Farm Workers Union and the Sierra Club, but both groups claim that they have cited research that the dairy's ammonia and other chemical emissions indeed put agricultural workers at risk. Investigators interviewed dozens of employees, reviewed the farm workers' compensation report for 2005 and illness logs from the past 5 years. They also conducted field tests on the farm and dairy. The dairy, southwest of Boardman, covers 93,000 acres. The farm and dairy employ about 300 employees year-round and 400 more seasonal workers. Eric Nicholson from the Pacific Northwest, regional director of the United Farm Workers of America, said his organization has yet to see the report.
Adelante Mujeres is a nonprofit based in Forest Grove. It offers a unique program that helps Latinas find their voice in the world. KABU's own Denise Kowalczyk has more.
Nancy Kristoff is an associate professor of Spanish at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. She teaches a literature class in Spanish to local low-income Latinas. Students of that class meet on campus to analyze and discuss great works of literature from Spanish-speaking countries. Her class is part of a program called Adelante Mujeres, a nonprofit based in nearby Forest Grove. Loosely translated, it means women getting ahead. And the mission of the program focuses on providing a variety of opportunities.
It's really about educating women so that they can get ahead, and especially or specifically Latina women here in Washington County, so that they can get ahead educationally as well as economically.
Kristoff says that it's a very unique program in its scope.
So this is a nonprofit organization that serves about 20 low-income Latina women and their preschool-aged children. And what's really neat about it is that it's an educational program that's every day, 8 a.m. to 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the women come and they study all day, and their preschool-age children are in a preschool in the same building. In addition to that, the women receive a small stipend.
And although the Adelante Mujeres program teaches women English and math, it also provides an opportunity to read and talk about Spanish language literature.
My particular area is a literature class that I teach them. So these women are educated on site. It's actually based in St. Anthony's Catholic Church here in Forest Grove. And they are working on math, reading skills, ESL, social studies, business, leadership, and crafts. But some of those women opt to come to Pacific University once a week and take a literature class with me in Spanish. I started out doing books and realized very soon that these women have very full lives. Most of them have children and husbands to take care of when they come home. And so they are not able to be assigned 50 pages to read from week to week. So we do short texts. We do short stories and poems, and that works really well.
Christoph describes the program as a voyage for most participants, as they are exposed to experiences not normally part of their daily lives. Each May, there's a graduation and a poetry recital at which the women read a mix of original poems they've written, as well as poems by famous female poets. For KBOO News, I'm Denise Kowalczyk.
And to hear the complete interview, tune in to Bread and Roses on Friday, April 28th at 6 p.m.
Lake Oswego City Commissioners are thinking hard about their first ever citywide ban in Oregon of garden products containing the chemical phosphorus. The move is a response to the extensive algae bloom, which is choking the private lake that gives this exclusive community its name. Besides the algae choking the lake, it has also been killing fish, and this has caused a spreading layer of floating slime in that man-made lake. Lake Oswego's proposed ban targets fertilizers and other products used to maintain lawns and gardens. Officials say phosphorus runs off the well-manicured lawns of mansions surrounding this lake, flowing into the city's storm water system and into the lake. Washington State banned phosphorus-bearing garden products on March 28th.
Thank you, Eduardo. A conservation group has listed the Willamette River as the third most endangered river in the United States. KBOO's Lisa Loving has more.
In a report issued yesterday, American Rivers said the Willamette made the list because industrial pollution poses a threat. The group specifically cited toxic mixing zones, areas below industrial outflows where pollution is allowed to mix with river water before being measured against state standards. The Willamette is the only Oregon river to make the group's 10 most endangered list this year. American Rivers has issued lists every year since 1986. The list isn't a ranking of the nation's most polluted waterways. The group said it identifies rivers where key decisions in the coming year could determine their futures. The group urged Governor Ted Kulongoski to order state regulators to phase out the use of mixing zones. Oregon Department of Environmental Quality officials said they've issued new guidelines that will strengthen the review of mixing zones and plan to ask the 2007 legislature for funding that would allow them to better identify the sources of toxic releases and the risks they pose to public health. The other rivers making the 2006 list in order of most endangered: the Pajaro River in California, Upper Yellowstone River in Montana, Salmon Trout River in Michigan, Shenandoah River in Virginia and West Virginia, Boise River in Idaho, Caloosahatchee River in Florida, Bristol Bay Watershed in Alaska, San Jacinto River in Texas, and the Verde River in Arizona. For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
A coalition of conservation groups in the state of Washington announced yesterday they're suing the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for failing to protect the Puget Sound Chinook salmon from the harmful effects of toxic pollution entering the sound. The group's alleged, the federal agency which oversees permits for pollution discharged into the Puget Sound is violating the Federal Endangered Species Act. Puget Sound Chinook are listed as a threatened species under the act. A letter forwarded to EPA officials calls on the agencies to start talking to the National Marine Fisheries Service immediately about ways to improve standards and permits issued to industry, local governments, and others that discharge industrial pollution, wastewater, and stormwater runoff. Barring quick action by the EPA, the group say they are going to file a lawsuit within 60 days. Joining the lawsuit are the National Wildlife Federation, People for Puget Sound, Washington Trout, Puget Sound Keeper Alliance, and Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility.
The court martial of a soldier accused of killing his wife has been postponed until May 15th. It had been scheduled to start Monday. Brandon Baer of Wilkesboro, North Carolina, is charged with premeditated murder in the death of an 18-year-old Nabila Baer. Last July in the couple's kitchen, she's been stabbed at least 70 times with knives and a meat cleaver. Baer was home after being wounded in Iraq in a grenade attack on his striker brigade until unit in Mosul. If convicted, Baer faces a minimum of life in prison.
Also in the state of Washington, the Olympian newspaper reports that Fort Lewis soldiers have welcomed the newest member of the Stryker family of vehicles. The 2nd Cavalry Regiment recently received the three vehicles that can detect radiation or biological and chemical hazards while keeping the soldiers safe inside, according to the paper. Stryker vehicles share the same chassis, but there are 9 other variants that fulfill different missions. The nuclear, biological, and chemical reconnaissance vehicle is the 9th variant. The 38-wheeled vehicles developed to fill a gap between infantry soldiers driving Humvees and tanks is the Army's next step in becoming a future fighting force, according to the officials. Soldiers of the regiment are busy working with the new model yesterday as they are training to become Fort Lewis's 3rd Stryker Brigade combat team. The post other 2 Stryker brigades already have completed year-long deployment in Iraq, and one of the brigades will deploy for a second time this summer. Both units are scheduled to receive the vehicles eventually.
With the expected passage of this spring of the largest emergency spending bill in history, annual war expenditures in Iraq will have nearly doubled since the U.S. invasion. The Washington Post reports today that annual war costs in Iraq are easily outpacing the $61 billion a year that the United States spent in Vietnam between 1964 and 1972 in today's dollars. The cost of Iraq war and U.S. fatalities has declined this year, but the cost in treasure continues to rise from $48 billion in 2003. The bill went up to $59 billion in 2004 and up to $81 billion in 2005. This year, we'll be spending an estimated $94 billion, according to the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. The U.S. government is now spending nearly $10 billion a month in Iraq and Afghanistan, up from $8.2 billion a year ago, a new Congressional Research Service report found. Eduardo?
Truth Throughout reports that White House Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald yesterday met with the grand jury hearing evidence in the CIA leak case and introduced additional evidence against Rove, attorneys, and other U.S. officials close to the investigation. That's what they said. Fitzgerald said he would soon present jurors with a list of criminal charges he intends to file against Rove in hopes of having the grand jury return a multi-count indictment against Rove. In an interview yesterday, Rove's attorney, Robert Luskin, confirmed that Rove remains a subject of Fitzgerald's 2-year-old probe. In a previous interview, Luskin asserted that Rove would not be indicted by Fitzgerald, but he was unwilling to make that prediction again Wednesday.
A leading international human rights group is calling for a special prosecutor to investigate the alleged involvement of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other senior Pentagon officials in the torture of a prisoner at Guantanamo Bay 3 years ago. Rumsfeld could be criminally liable under federal or military law for the abuse and torture of detainee Mohammed al-Qahtani in late 2002 and early 2003, the New York-based Human Rights Watch said this week, as Democratic lawmakers demanded that Rumsfeld step down as Pentagon chief. Last week, a military report obtained by Salon.com included a statement by Lieutenant General Randall Smith that raises serious questions about the conduct of the Pentagon chief, as well as other officials concerning al-Qahtani's interrogation. In the report, General Schmidt says that Rumsfeld was talking weekly with General Jeffrey Miller, a senior commander at Guantanamo in early 2003, about the al-Qahtani interrogation and that he was personally involved in that interrogation.
More relatives of people who died on 9/11 are set to testify today on behalf of Zacharias Moussaoui. Those who testified yesterday said they didn't want to succumb to feelings of revenge. Moussaoui's lawyers hope this testimony will counter the emotional impact of nearly four dozen witnesses who gave heartbreaking testimony for prosecutors about the impact of the attacks. Witnesses aren't allowed to give an opinion on whether Moussaoui should get the death penalty or life in prison, but the defense witnesses made their feelings clear. Marilyn Rosenthal's son died in the World Trade Center, and she says her family does not want to get caught in a whirlpool of sadness and anger. One man who emotionally told of reconnecting with his father 2 years before the attacks said he can't be vengeful and still have an open heart. Some 9/11 families didn't approve of the decision to testify for Moussaoui. The sister of the pilot of the plane that crashed into the Pentagon said she found it deeply disturbing.
More on Moussaoui in this essay. It's recorded from Pennsylvania's death row. FSRN commentator Mumia Abu Jamal, describes Moussaoui's upbringing in France.
The road to 9/11, Moussaoui's journey. While the name Zacharias Moussaoui may be known to millions, especially as his sentencing hearing comes to an end, it is highly unlikely that millions of people know of his origins and what kind of forces formed his worldview and perspectives that led to the death and destruction of 9/11. 3 years ago, the progressive New York-based publisher, Seven Stories, released a slim volume written by the brother of Zacharias, Abdessamad Moussaoui, who told the tale of what growing up in southern France meant for the North African family. If ever one wanted to see a non-Muslim family, the Moussaouis were it. Their mother, Aisha, never taught the boys to speak Arabic, but as Abdessamad recalls it, on a visit back to his ancestral land, Morocco, friends and relatives would express shock and dismay that the Moussaoui boys couldn't speak Arabic. Meskin, they would say, poor things. Their mother would respond proudly, they're right little French boys, those two. In the book, Zacharias, My Brother, The Making of a Terrorist, published in 2003, Abdessamad Moussaoui told of how being born in France and speaking only the French tongue didn't equate to feeling or being treated as French by other French people. Abdessamad's recollections are rife with alienation, both from the land of their birth, France, and from the land of their ancestry, Morocco. They knew no prayers nor Islamic history. As the explosions in French suburbs showed us recently, they were not alone in their alienation. But what radicalized Zacharias, Abdessamad insists, more than anything else was the Gulf War. Abdessamad writes, student debates inevitably gravitated not only to the Gulf War, but also to the situation in Palestine and the civil war in Algeria. Decisive conflicts for all Muslims throughout the world. For hours, we talked about the legitimacy of the intervention in Iraq. For us, Saddam Hussein had no right to invade a country the way he had, but neither was anyone entitled to massacre the Iraqi people in response. We were shocked by the war show, which was so overhyped by the media. And in such a one-sided way, the so-called surgical strikes sickened us. According to Abdessamad, the first Gulf War was a radicalizing force in the life and mind of Zacharias Moussaoui and for many others. It soured them, not just on the U.S., but on France as well. Absamad wrote, "The war crystallized feelings against American imperialism, political and economic. Zach, myself, and our friends felt that the France that sent in troops to fight alongside the Americans was not our France. The flames lit decades ago in a boy named Zacharias still simmer to this day. It matters little whether the imperial court sends a man to death for a crime at which he wasn't present. The flames leap from match to match until the real causes are addressed. That, it seems, is still some ways away." From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The current time is 5:20. Don't go away, because coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Native Americans in Nevada are trying to stop the testing of a nuclear bomb in the desert. War spending in Iraq is surpassing the cost of the Vietnam War. And the violence in Nepal continues. You're listening to Community Handcrafted Radio, KBOO, for Portland, Vancouver, Cornwallis, and Hood River.
ACLU filed two amicus briefs to a national security agency spying suit today. Meanwhile, the Bush administration continues to deny requests by Congress for officials to testify on the program. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has more on this.
One amicus brief was filed by civil rights organizations. They say the NSA spying program reveals unchecked power, which led to abusive surveillance of civil rights advocates and specific groups of Americans in the past. Kareem Sharom is with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee.
We feel that this is an issue that has not only trampled on our most fundamental liberties and constitutional rights, however, it's of special concern to members of the Arab American and broader Middle Eastern American community.
The second brief was filed by business organizations who fear a loss of privacy for their customers. Michael Kishnick, president and co-founder of Working Assets Funding Service, a telecommunications, credit card, and media company.
Unfortunately, we and any other business can no longer assume that our customers have privacy when they make a telephone call. The Bush administration has eliminated that.
The administration began the wiretapping program in 2001. The program did not seek approval from Congress, and it bypasses the process of obtaining a warrant from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Courts in order to wiretap Americans who are speaking with a suspected member of a terrorist organization overseas. The president says inherent powers allows him to expand the wiretapping program. More than a month ago, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit in district court in Michigan stating that the NSA spying program is unconstitutional. The ACLU says the First and Fourth Amendments are being violated, as are the separation of powers. Just weeks ago, the administration began briefing seven members of the Senate Intelligence Committee on details. Congress reconvenes next week, and the Senate Judiciary Committee, which has been holding hearings on the subject, is expected to resume work on legislation directing the program. But critics of the program say legislation cannot be passed because public details are unknown, which is why ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy from Vermont, has been calling for a subpoena of administration officials to testify. Senator Leahy on March 31st.
The American people have a right to know whether or not this president knowingly chose to flout the law when he instructed the NSA to spy on the American people. And that is why our next step should be to subpoena the opinions. We know the president broke the law. Now we need to know why.
Leahy's spokesperson said today that he will, quote, absolutely continue to press for answers, especially after Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified before the House Judiciary Committee and insinuated that there are additional programs running. New York Democrat Senator Chuck Schumer has introduced a bill that would put the debate on a fast track to the Supreme Court. He also supports the subpoena of administration officials.
There are many reports that people very high up in the administration, former Attorney General Ashcroft, Deputy Attorney General Comey, head of the OLC, Goldschmidt, had real doubts about the president doing this on his own without getting the approval of Congress. And so they should testify, by all means. These are important issues. And for these people who are willing to testify, not to be allowed to testify, because the administration is using a very broad interpretation of executive privilege, which I think is self-serving, is wrong.
A majority is necessary for the committee to issue a subpoena, which would need the support of Republicans, which so far has been unsuccessful. Oral arguments for the ACLU suit are scheduled for mid-June. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
An indigenous nation and several nuclear fallout downwinders want a federal court to halt plans for a huge non-nuclear blast that's expected to generate a massive mushroom cloud over the Nevada desert. A Reno-based lawyer representing four members of the Western Shoshone Nation and two non-indigenous residents of Utah calls the planned Divine Strike blast a worst nightmare come true for the downwinders. He says detonating a 700-ton ammonium nitrate and fuel oil bomb at the Nevada test site will stir up radioactive fallout left from 100 above ground and 828 underground nuclear weapon tests conducted from the now infamous era of 1951 to 1992. The lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court in Las Vegas names Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and the chiefs of the two federal agencies planning the blast. But not surprising, there's no comment yet from the Defense Department or test planners. However, test site officials have said the blast won't be near where nuclear testing was done and shouldn't kick up surface contamination.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff and Immigration and Customs Enforcement Assistant Secretary Julie Myers announced a new immigration enforcement strategy today, identifying and removing undocumented immigrants who have been convicted of a crime. Will be a top strategy, along with ensuring employers' compliance to hire documented workers. The ACLU and immigrant worker groups are criticizing some of these measures, which they say contradict Congress's efforts to find workable legislation on immigration. Anastasia Gnedetskaya reports from D.C.
Our nation's communities cannot be a wild frontier where illegal aliens and unscrupulous employers subvert our nation's laws.
This statement by Julie Myers, Assistant Secretary for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has set the stage for today's press conference on the recent measures of ICE to arrest and deport seven managers of the Phoenix-based company IFCO Systems for allegedly hiring undocumented workers across the U.S. and even overseas. The department says that more than 1,100 workers were arrested in 26 states. According to Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff, the operation signals the department's intent to increase arrest raids on workers and possible fines and charges against employers. The move, in Chertoff's words, is to prevent the exploitation of illegal aliens.
What we're focused on is not just individual cases involving a single violator here or a single violator there, but actually looking at those people who adopt as a business model the systematic violation of United States law.
Department of Homeland Security requested the Congress to give it access to Social Security mismatch data. Such a provision is now a part of the bill that Senate is to vote on. Caroline Fredrickson, Director of Legislative Office of ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, says this bill, if adopted, will have negative impact on the entire U.S. workforce.
The language of the bill sets up a massive government database, so-called Employment Eligibility Verification System, which would allow the government basically to deny people the ability to work if there is some kind of glitch in the database. So I think we would all be in danger of trying to apply for a job and your prospective employer says, gosh, I can't hire you because your information's not coming back right.
Myers added that Homeland has set and increased a target deportation rate at 10% per year. She also threatened employers with increased sentences.
We've learned all too well from watching the old INF that just a small fine or a slap on the wrist is not a deterrent to businesses who want to violate our worksite enforcement laws. That's the reason that we see more robust criminal cases built against negligent and blatantly violating the law employers as a much stronger deterrent. The prospect of 10 years in prison carries a much sharper teeth than just a small fine.
A group of immigrant organizations protested today in front of ICE building against such strict measures. Emma Lozano and Julie Santos from the Family Unity Campaign.
Here in the USA, there's a human rights violation in the world today, right here in the USA.
There were 4 raids in Chicago. 25 innocent families were destroyed. And the recent raids by the Department of Homeland Security in Chicago and in various other places in the nation were timed to intimidate the historic movement for legalization of the undocumented, unification of families, and comprehensive immigration reform, which came so close to fixing our broken immigration laws 10 days ago in the Senate.
And we're asking for an immediate moratorium on all the raids and deportations until the Senate and Congress can fully debate this issue. Right now, we're so close for legalization, it's the wrong time to do raids.
According to Fredrickson, such a timing for raids and arrests could be explained by the position of the president in the immigration debate.
The Bush administration has been coming under a lot of criticism for not being part of the debate. When Congress got into that debate, he didn't get his hands dirty at all. He let them duke it out between different factions of the Republican Party. So now I think they're trying to make it up to different parts of their party. You know, when the president says on one day, I think we need to have some kind of a guest worker program, and the next day they start cracking down on employers, they have the two wings that they're trying to placate.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezdetskaya in Washington, D.C.
A nightclub owner in New Orleans is protesting what he calls a violent raid on his club by local, state, and federal law enforcement people. Criminal Justice Report groups say the raid follows patterns of police brutality and the targeting of black youth there, patterns that were out of control even before last fall's storms. FSRN's Christian Roseland is in New Orleans and files this report.
In the dark hours before morning, April 11th, dozens of officers from Louisiana Alcohol and Tobacco Control, the New Orleans Police Department, and the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives entered Sam's Place, a small New Orleans hip-hop club, with guns drawn. Sims Jacobs owns the building above Sam's Place and is one of several eyewitnesses who told FSRN that during the raid, police tasered, strip-searched, and groped clubgoers.
I saw men ask to pull down their pants. I saw women's rights being violated. I saw them actually getting searched by men. I saw maybe 3 people get tasered. You know, police used as a torture method when they thought that they was lying or they thought that maybe they could get them to confess to something.
Jacobs went to New Orleans City Council today with several hundred signatures of neighbors to call for an end to what he describes as constant police harassment of the club. Jacobs says he also has the support of pastors of 2 local churches, one of which is across the street. Jerome Temple, known locally as DJ Jubilee, was playing music when the raid occurred. Temple says that what happened at Sam's follows a pattern he's seen in other hip-hop clubs.
You still ain't gonna stop crime. All I'm saying is this. You get 300 murders a year in the city of New Orleans. You get less than 6 happen at a club.
The NOPD was unavailable for comment, but referred FSRN to the State Department of Alcohol and Tobacco Control, which also did not return calls by airtime. However, in a press release, the NOPD states that it was accompanying alcohol and tobacco control on a check of the club's liquor license, that 17 arrests were made, and that drugs and firearms were seized. Song Hong of the criminal justice reform group Safe Streets says there are many places where the police routinely accost black youth.
These include barbershops. These include certain like hip-hop fashion stores, as well as, you know, certain bars, where if you're seen hanging out there, you're sure to get harassed by any police that are in the area.
New Orleans will vote in 3 days for a new mayor who will choose the next police chief. Some candidates have focused on stopping crime as a campaign issue, but for Sims Jacobs, safety on the streets of New Orleans starts with the police.
Everybody's running for office and they're using this zero tolerance. And I think that zero tolerance should be used on the against the police and not against the people. And that's what I want people to focus on, because right now, the people don't feel safe with the police.
For FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland.
Freddie Mac will pay a record $3.8 million fine to Seattle Civic charges that it violated federal election law. The mortgage corporation chartered by the federal government used corporate resources to raise $1.7 million at political fundraisers. The agreement with the Federal Election Committee Commission settles allegations that the company violated election law by contributing $150,000 to the Republican Governors Association in 2002. Freddie Mac agreed to the settlement without admitting or denying it broke the law. Records from the agreement show Freddie Mac pumped money into the campaigns of more than 50 politicians who had direct oversight or were considered supportive of it. Federal law prohibits companies from donating directly to candidates or using corporate money for such fundraising. In a key part of the settlement, Freddie Mac asked and the FEC agreed to end its investigations of the former executives involved in the fundraising activities. The current time is 5:35, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's time to call 911 about an IRS proposal to change Section 7216 of the Internal Revenue Code. Whenever the Bushites revise regulations, you can bet that the revisions do the exact opposite of what the regulatory title claims they do. In this case, the change is titled Regulations to Safeguard Taxpayer Information. Uh-oh, this can't be good. Our friendly IRS quietly issued this little gem on December 8th, cleverly lumping it in with a set of new rules that the agency labeled not a significant regulatory action, hoping that no one would notice. Fortunately, watchdog groups didn't buy the ruse. When they actually read IRS's proposed safeguards, they were startled to find that this regulation would authorize giants like H&R Block or any other tax preparer to sell the contents of your private tax return to any corporation wanting to buy it. All of your personal contact information, including your Social Security number, could be sold, as well as information about your income, employer, medical expenses, children, charitable donations, etc. Who's pushing this crass sell-off of our privacy? There's a powerful lobby of data brokers such as ChoicePoint, credit companies like MasterCard, and dozens of marketers who want to use your 1040 filing to target you for sales. In the shadows, of course, identity thieves lurk, eager to raid the computers of data firms and grab your tax return as a one-stop shopping bonanza. Oh, tut-tut, says the head honcho of IRS. Your data will not be sold unless you sign a form authorizing your tax preparer to do it. But this so-called consent can be shuffled in with a stack of forms you have to sign to complete your filing, or it can be reduced to fine print, boilerplate language that no one reads. This is Jim Hightower saying our tax return information should not be sold, period. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Americans are leaving the nation's big cities in search of cheaper homes and open spaces farther out. Nearly every large metropolitan area in the country had more people move out than move in from 2000 to 2004, with a few exceptions in the South and Southwest, according to a report released today by the Census Bureau. Northeasterners are moving south and west. West Coast residents are moving inland. Midwesterners are chasing better job markets, and just about everywhere people are escaping to the outer suburbs, also known as exurbs. It's a fight for housing affordability, says William Frey, a demographer at the Brookings Institution, a Washington, D.C. think tank. Frey says it's not just white middle-class flight, it's Hispanics and blacks, too. The Census Bureau measured domestic migration, people moving within the United States, from 1990 to 2000, and from 2000 to 2004. The United States government has released the most extensive list to date of detainees held in Guantanamo Bay detention camp in Cuba. The names of 558 people were released on Wednesday in response to a Freedom of Information lawsuit by the Associated Press. Most of those in detention are from Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and Afghanistan. It is the first official list of Guantanamo detainees who have appeared before tribunals to assess whether they should remain under detention. Around 490 detainees remain in Guantanamo Bay, which opened in January 2002.
Agence France-Presse reports that nearly 20,000 people have been kidnapped in Iraq since the beginning of this year alone. The survey released yesterday underscores the massive social upheaval caused by rebel activity and increasing sectarian conflict. It does not give the number of people killed. However, it says that 15,462 people have been wounded. The 19,548 people kidnapped includes 4,959 women, 2,350 children, according to the report prepared by a group of 125 non-governmental organizations and made public in the Shia holy city of Karbala. The high-profile seizure of foreigners in Iraq has numbered only a few hundred since the practice began 2 years ago. Is usually aimed at scoring propaganda points against the U.S.-led occupation. In contrast, the thousands of Iraqis being kidnapped are primarily the victims of political rivalry and of common criminal gangs seeking ransom.
Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim Jafari said today he would consider stepping down as his party's nominee for prime minister in the next government, giving the new hope that a four-month-old deadlock over forming the government might be solved soon. FSRN's David Enders reports from Baghdad.
Jafari's nomination is unpalatable to Sunnis and Kurds and has caused dissent within the Shiite bloc itself as the parties that make up the coalition of religious Shiite parties fight for power. Kurds complain that Jafari has refused to discuss the status of the northern oil city of Kirkuk, which the Kurds claim is their own. Both the Kurds and some Shiites dislike Jafari because he favors a strong central government, while others would like to see Iraq's previously neglected provinces have greater autonomy. Azad Jindiani is a spokesman for the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which is led by current Iraqi President Jalal Talabani.
Ibrahim Jafari is a selfish man. He wants to make all decisions by himself. The Constitution of Iraq states that decisions should be taken by consulting the president and the vice presidents.
Sunnis see Jafari as having presided over a government in which they have come to fear Shiite death squads, both inside and outside the government. Jafari's main backing came from his own Dao party and followers of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Sadr's followers have threatened to boycott the government if Jafari steps down. Sayyid Amar is the commander of Sadr's militia in Baghdad.
If Jafari is forced to move from his place, the sectarian violence will be worse. Jafari does not differentiate between any sect, and he cares for everyone in Iraq, not just the Shiites.
Jafari had initially said he would not step down unless asked to do so by Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the country's ranking Shiite cleric, but it was unclear if Sistani had intervened. It was also unclear how Sadr's followers might react. Among those mentioned as replacements for Jafari were Jawad al-Maliki and Ali al-Adib, both deputies of the Dawa party. Neither is believed to differ much from Jafari's views on major issues. A date has not been set for the next meeting of parliament, nor has it been stipulated when and how a new candidate might be chosen. Jafari was selected by a vote amongst the Shiite bloc. Also today, militia violence continued as gunmen attacked a Sunni mosque in the southern Baghdad district of Saidiya, sparking an hour-long clash before dawn with guards at the mosque and residents. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
Nepal's King Gyanendra is caught up in a whirlpool of unprecedented crises caused by the growing pro-democracy movement against his 14 months of autocratic rule. Some say his advisors misled him into the move to usurp power on February 1, 2005, throttling the 15-year adolescent democracy that was born in 1990 amid mass protests against the old regime. The king's offer for dialogue with the political parties indicates to some that he wants to rectify the situation, even leading some old political leaders to believe the king and enter into dialogue with him. But there are others wanting to restore total democracy. They question the king's intentions. FSRN's PC Dubey has more from Nepal.
Thousands of protesters thronged the streets of Kathmandu despite knowledge of an 18-hour curfew and army orders to shoot on sight. Soldiers followed those orders and not only fired rubber bullets and tear gas shells, but live ammunition that killed three protesters on the spot and seriously injured over 50. By year time, the exact number of casualties was unknown. Meanwhile, the royalist government has extended the curfew by 7 hours beyond midnight local time. Today's bloodbath is the worst in the capital since the king usurped power in February 2005 to ostensibly combat the 10-year-old Maoist insurgency. But instead of combating the Maoists, the army has begun to kill citizens agitating for democracy. Ironically, the Maoists began their insurgency in 1996 against both the king and the political parties heading the government. Now both the political parties and the Maoists are pushing for the king's abdication of absolute power and constitutional changes that would prevent this from happening again. Devendralal Nepali, a senior leader of the Nepali Congress, describes that the king's bid to revive democracy under the 1990 constitution as chasing a mirage. He says people won't trust the democracy stemming from the current format of the constitution.
I have appealed to His Majesty's government that either we must have constituent assembly or have amendments in the present constitution. On this issue, going for a referendum is the only option, nothing else.
On April 6th, the Seven-Party Alliance, or SPA, launched the longest and fiercest national strike and protest campaign against King Gyanendra's autocracy, forcing the king into dialogue. Since then, security forces have killed 14, maimed over 1,500, and detained some 3,000 protesters. As the rising tide of the protest appears unstoppable, more and more ordinary citizens are joining demonstrations, turning it into a people's movement. Ram Iqbal Chaudhary, a Tharu tribal political analyst, claims that the royalist government is on shaky ground and the political parties are basking in massive support.
The situation is such that they are not in favor of dialogue with the king. If he wants to remain a ceremonial king, then political parties may think to talk. Otherwise, now the balance is tipped toward the political parties, so they won't bow before the king. There's fire all around. Professors, doctors, engineers, bank employees have stopped working. Civil servants have come onto the roads.
Nevertheless, former prime ministers are claiming that the current political stalemate in the country could be resolved under the 1990 constitution and restoration of the dissolved parliament. They spurned the need for a constituent assembly to draft a new constitution. But seven-party alliance leaders are not buying such a thesis. Their thesis is that any opportunistic compromise with the king without roping in the Maoists won't ensure peace in the country, because Maoists would never give up their demand for the constituent assembly. Asa Chaturvedi is chairperson of the Women Forum of Sadbhavana Party, a member, is a strong voice of such a thesis.
Our target is a constituent assembly. Even the Maoist first and last goal is a constituent assembly. See, the constituent assembly is the only solution to all these problems. In between compromise, reinstatement of parliament, whatever will happen, they are not at all permanent solutions to our crisis.
Nevertheless, the king does not appear willing to comply with the political party's demands for a constituent assembly. Even the Indian Prime Minister's special envoy, Karan Singh, a relative of King Gyanendra, is in Kathmandu to woo the king to confer power to political parties, but Singh appears to have accomplished little. This means violence and protests could escalate in Nepal. Parties say they will continue the movement till the king is ousted. Even civil servants have no longer remained loyal to the crown. It also remains to be seen how long the Nepalese army will stay loyal. King Gyanendra is expected to make an announcement to defuse the crisis, but none knows what is in the offing. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm P.C. Dubey in Kathmandu.
The European Commission has ignored the advice of European Union scientists and has been authorizing new genetically modified crops. Campaigners say a dossier they just obtained shows the Commission is favoring the interest of biotechnology industry over health and the environment. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
When the European Commission broke the moratorium on GM foods, forcing them into Europe, it told the public they were safe. But through the Freedom of Information Act, Friends of the Earth has obtained a dossier of scientific evidence that the European Union sent to the World Trade Organization. Campaigners say the Commission not only knew of the safety issues, but they acted against European Union scientific concerns. This raises serious questions for the European Union in terms of how official opinions on safety issues are treated and decisions taken. It also reinforces criticism of the European Commission itself, which consists of 20 unelected representatives appointed by member states. For years it's been dogged by allegations of nepotism, mismanagement and even fraud. Campaigners are now calling on the European Commission to halt the sale and import of all GM crops and products in the EU until its fears over the crop's uncertain effects on health and the environment have been allayed. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
In a follow-up to a story covered Thursday, Argentine Piquetero leader Raúl Castells was released last night after 2 days in jail. Castells was arrested on Monday when attempting to inaugurate a soup kitchen in one of Argentina's most exclusive neighborhoods. A judge ruled yesterday that the charges against the Piquetero leader, quote, lacked merit. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
In Nigeria, militants fighting against oil exploitation in the Niger Delta region have claimed responsibility for a car bomb attack on an army barracks. Sam Ulukoya reports from Lagos.
In the dark hours before morning, April 11th, dozens of officers from Louisiana Alcohol and Tobacco Control, the New Orleans Police Department, and the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives entered Sam's Place, a small New Orleans hip-hop club, with guns drawn. Sims Jacobs owns the building above Sam's Place and is one of several eyewitnesses who told FSRN that during the raid, police tasered, strip-searched, and groped clubgoers.
I saw men like to pull down their pants. I saw women's rights being violated. I saw them actually getting searched by men. I saw maybe three people get tasered. You know, police used it as a torture method when they thought that they was lying or they thought that maybe they could get them to confess to something.
Jacobs went to New Orleans City Council today with several hundred signatures of neighbors to call for an end to what he describes as constant police harassment of the club. Jacobs says he also has the support of pastors of two local churches, one of which is across the street. Jerome Temple, known locally as DJ Jubilee, was playing music when the raid occurred. Temple says that what happened at Sam's follows a pattern he's seen in other hip-hop clubs.
You still ain't gonna stop crime. All I'm saying is this. You get 300 murders a year in the city of New Orleans. You get less than six happen at a club.
The NOPD was unavailable for comment, but referred FSRN to the State Department of Alcohol and Tobacco Control, which also did not return calls by airtime. However, in a press release, the NOPD states that it was accompanying Alcohol and Tobacco Control.
We apologize for a technical problem. So here's another story. Tensions are high today in southwestern Ontario as police and native police are in a face-off as we speak at a construction site. From Toronto, Christine Schwartz has more.
Early this morning, police stormed a construction site occupied by native people from the nearby Six Nations Reserve community, making a number of arrests. The occupation began 7 weeks ago to prevent the expansion of a housing development. The Six Nations people say that the site is part of a large tract of land that was promised to them by the British Crown in 1784. The traditional Six Nations Confederacy government backs the blockade and doesn't recognize the authority of the elected Band Council, established by Canada early this century, to represent them in the negotiations. Janie Jameson is a spokesperson for the blockade participants.
Since 1924, Canada has violated international law and they continue to ignore the existence of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. That's what this is all about. It's got to end at some point.
Six Nations people rallied and regained control of the site after the arrests this morning. Hundreds of police have now been deployed in the area. From CKLN in Toronto, this is Kristen Schwartz for Free Speech Radio News.
The Tamil Tiger rebels have indefinitely postponed peace talks with the Sri Lankan government. FSRN reports from Vavuniya.
Tamil Tigers told reporters today that escalating violence against Tamil civilians is the reason for not attending the peace talks scheduled to start on April 24th in Geneva. The announcement came amid some of the worst bloodshed since the 2002 truce signed between the government and the rebels. John Hansenbauer is the Norwegian special envoy to Sri Lanka. He is on a 3-day visit to the island nation to kickstart the peace negotiation between the government and the Tamil Tigers.
The first step is now to bring an immediate cessation of all acts of violence. Norway condemns in the strongest possible terms the latest acts of violence that have occurred on this island.
Traders said the stock market dipped for the second straight day following reports of the postponement of peace talks. Nearly 70 people, mostly security forces, have been killed and scores wounded in the latest surge since April 7th. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 20th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032. Leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA. In Hood River, we're at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You may log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our assistant producer is Josh Johnson. Special thanks to reporter Denise Kowalczyk. And our engineer is Josh Johnson. Sorry, Josh. Josh Johnson, the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director, is Lisa Loving. And I'm Marlise Franklin.
And I happen to be Eduardo Dillon de los Tierra. Keep your radio tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., here are the KBOO Morning News. Then at 7:30, it's Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, I'm Marlene's Electronic Salon. Marlene holds a freewheeling discussion of current events with sidekick Ed Goldberg. At 1:30 p.m., Buscando America will feature radio from Caracas, Venezuela, and also something on the May 1st mobilization on anti-immigrant legislation. I, Eduardo, is going to be hosting the show. At 5 p.m., catch the KBO Evening News, followed by CompuSpin. At 6, feminist news and commentary on Bread and Roses. And that's all right here on KBOO. And this is your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored, grassroots radio station. Cuídate, chao.
This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 20th of April. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A former police officer in Nome, Alaska, has been sentenced to 101 years in prison for executing a young Eskimo woman and for stealing a police car to divert the investigation. Paul Korchin from KNOM has more.
Superior Court Judge Ben Esch imposed the sentence on 30-year-old Matthew Owens before a crowded courtroom Monday.
Someone who so inexplicably commits such a crime is equally uncertain to be deterred from future criminality. Because the court has found a number of aggravating factors, and based upon the finding this crime was premeditated, the court will sentence the defendant to the maximum sentence on count one. I hereby, on that count, impose a sentence of 99 years.
Owens also received 2 years for evidence tampering. He was convicted by a largely Native jury at a second trial in December of shooting 19-year-old Sonia Ivanov in the back of the head while on duty nearly 3 years ago. Esch noted the great damage Owens' crimes have done to the region, including Ivanov's home village of Unalakleet, along with the harm to public trust in law enforcement. Before the sentencing, Sonia's father, Larry Ivanov, told the court of his family's high hopes for their daughter.
We had faith that Sonia was going to go through all the way, and she had to come here and go to work, try to make a living so she can get more money to go to college. And then she ran into a murder person that didn't care what he did to other people, whether he was an officer. How can anyone be able to kill another person for no reasons at all?
Owens himself spoke briefly, protesting his innocence and referring to Ivanov's death as a most unfortunate situation. Owens is eligible for sentence reduction and parole after serving at least one-third of his century-long sentence. The defense says it will appeal the conviction. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
The former leader of the American Indian Movement says gains have been made, but every generation needs to continue working for change. As Johanna Saylor reports, artist and American Indian activist John Trudell made the comments in Vermilion, South Dakota this week at the beginning of a symposium on national Indian policy.
The suspicious death of his wife and young children pushed John Trudell to leave organized political activism and explore his creative side.
accepting the beauty.
Trudell's blend of spoken word, blues, and traditional native vocals has given him an outlet for his anger, and music became his retaliation. Trudell says he's learned that arts and culture is a more effective way at bringing about change than using the political process.
We can express our realities more realistically through our culture and our art, because that represents the truth of who we are and how we feel. Political, see, it's somebody else's politics. Somebody else controls the politics. Somebody else defines the politics. But we define our own culture and our own art. So I think that our most valid realities and expressions will come from our culture and our art.
Trudell says while gains have been made, every generation must work to build respect for Native American culture and rights. The conference at the University of South Dakota has brought together a range of experts on Indian policy to discuss the past 50 years from termination to sovereignty. I'm Johanna Saylor in Vermilion, South Dakota.
Schools in North Dakota are short on American Indian administrators, especially principals. So United Tribes Technical College and the University of North Dakota have teamed up to recruit more educators from North Dakota tribal nations. UTTC Project Director Sherry Bear King-Baker says as part of the $1 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education, students will train first at United Tribes, then move into UND's graduate degree program.
As part of their obligation for their grant, the students have agreed to go back and serve in a school with a significant amount of American Indian population as part of their commitment to that school and to the students and for receiving the financial help that they've gotten while they were getting their education.
King-Baker says academics will improve if tribal schools have more American Indian role models who are administrators. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. And by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com.